Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
You know me, I like to share good news where I can find it, and I've got some for you. You may remember pro-life activist Mark Houck, H-O-U-C-K. He's a father of many, and the FBI raided his home and arrested him. They had guns drawn and scared the kids. It was a big mess, way overreaction. And he was acquitted in court on a charge of trying to interfere with abortions. So here's how it's reported this morning in the Catholic News Agency. Pro-life activist Mark Houck was found not guilty yesterday on federal assault charges stemming from a shoving incident outside a Philadelphia abortion clinic. Supporters of the Catholic father of seven cried and hugged one another after the verdict was read in the U.S. District Court in Philadelphia. Following his acquittal, Houck told reporters outside the courthouse that it's a relief and he feels overjoyed and blessed. And we have some audio of him, and we'll play that in a moment. Peter Breen, Thomas More Society Executive VP and head of litigation, told reporters that the Department of Justice's prosecution of Houck was abusive and added that the FBI raid on the Houck family in September was absolutely outrageous. Breen said he hopes the U.S. Congress will ask Houck and his family to testify to the suffering that they went through at the hands of the Justice Department. Following Breen's comment, Houck said, "We'll be there." The prosecutors declined to comment after the verdict. The jury began deliberations on the case on Friday, but said they were deadlocked and would not come to a decision that night. They resumed deliberations Monday, and an alternate juror took the place of one of the original jurors at about 1:30 p.m. After a brief deliberation, the jury found Houck not guilty on both counts. And there's more. And yes, we will post this article for you. And for those who wonder where we're posting it, you'll find it on the show Twitter feed at P Madrid Show, which shows up automatically on the show page, relevantradio.com. Cyrus, I believe we've got some audio of Mr. Houck after the announcement of his acquittal, right?
Yeah, that's right. And it looked like this is him coming down the court steps.
Okay. Tell me how your faith has brought you and your family through this process.
We couldn't have done it without faith. Honestly, from day one, the moment of the arrest, when I found out that this was even an issue, it was all a leap of faith, stepping out and trusting in God and his protection. And he's been there every step of the way through his people. Through God's people, there's been so many prayers answered, but just his peace that, you know, was beyond understanding, as we know, and the joy that was filling our heart that God would choose my wife and children worthy to suffer in this way for the cause, for the movement, for the church, for the body of Christ. So we just felt privileged, and faith has brought us to that point where we feel that. So we've grown in faith. We've asked God to give us greater faith. And through today in this process, through Thomas More, through Brian McMonagle's Yes, we have greater faith and trust in God than ever. So we move forward with great, great confidence.
That's great. Congratulations to the Houck family. And I'm so glad that this went the way it did. It's time to move forward and move in the right direction as far as life is concerned. But isn't it true that the forces of darkness, and I think we could safely call them the forces of darkness, that are promoting the wanton killing of unborn children through abortion, as we saw in the new law that was passed in Minnesota, right up to the time of birth? I mean, that's how ghoulish these people are. So let us continue praying, and we have our Memorare campaign still ramped up to pray 500 million Memorares. I think, what's the number we're aiming for, Cyrus? Is it 600 million Memorares? I think it is.
Yeah, in fact, I'll go to the relevantradio.com. It's right there at the top.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Right on the homepage. Thank you. I have a quick email I want to read. It's not intended for younger ears. It has to do with marriage, and I'm going to leave anonymous the lady who wrote in on this question. But it's very simple, but it's not appropriate for children. So, fair warning, parents, turn the radio down for about 2 minutes at the most, and then turn it back up again or shoo the kids into the other room. Fair warning. Ready, steady, go. So this anonymous lady, she says, After a hysterectomy, if a woman can no longer have intercourse or the marriage act, is it a sin to continue having relations with her husband? The answer is yes or no, depending upon what you mean by that. So, the church teaches that every completed act of the marital embrace, I'm going to use a few roundabout terms here, but I think you know what I'm talking about. Every completed act, now by completed, we can think in terms of either the husband or the wife or both, must be completed in the natural fashion. In other words, it must be open to the possibility of procreation. It doesn't mean that there will be procreation. It just means that the act itself has to be completed in such a way that it could be open to conception. So any act that involves completion on either part or both that doesn't finish in that way would be a sin. Now, that doesn't mean that the couple cannot show signs of affection and all the things that are proper to marriage and the sanctity of marriage, within which all of these signs of affection are entirely permissible, and the couple has a right to that, including up to and including the marriage act itself. But those signs of affection should never take either or both of them beyond the point so that the act would finish in a way that's not natural. So that's the way to look at it. That's the way to understand it. And hysterectomies notwithstanding, there's nothing that would prevent the couple from enjoying this good of marriage because that's proper to their married state. So hysterectomy doesn't interfere with that or anything like that. Just keep in mind that the act itself, if it should go to that point, has to be completed in the natural fashion. I hope that's helpful, and I appreciate your email. We have so many inquiries on this topic. I can't get to all of them, but the reason I do read some of them on the air is because I can just tell from the tremendous influx of questions from men and women on this topic. It leads me to see that this is something that is very much on people's minds, and they don't know where to turn to get answers. So I'm happy I can be of service in that regard. Let's go now to Joanne in, is it Sauk Rapids, Minnesota? Do I have the name right?
Yes.
Great. Welcome, Joanne.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm going to give you a little bit of a background. I have a daughter-in-law who I love dearly. My son is Catholic, and my daughter-in-law really was brought up without any religion. Mm-hmm. And prior to their marriage, I had tried to encourage my son. I wasn't going directly to her. I was going to my son. But somehow it got out to her. I was trying to encourage my son to get married in the Catholic Church, obviously. And she took it as I didn't approve of her. Well, there was like about a year and a half rocky time, really rocky time, between us. But on their wedding day, again, they didn't get married in the Catholic Church, she hugged me and she said she wanted to start over. And I said, I do too. And it's been great since then. Through my son, I've learned that she is in the process of going through the RCIA program. And I'm excited, but I'm not going to approach her about it because she's very sensitive and can easily take things the wrong way. Mm-hmm. So I have to be careful. But I understand that she's supposed to be received into the Catholic Church this coming Easter. And I would like to give her a book or a gift or something to commemorate this special event. But I don't want to be too forceful or I think
that's,
you know, where I'm going.
Thoughtful of you.
So yeah. I was wondering if you have any suggestions of a gift or a book that might be something for someone who is, to kind of be careful with.
Yeah, I do. I think I've got what I would like to think is just the thing, because I wrote a book called Now What? A Guide for New and Not So New Catholics. And I wrote it for people just like her, people who are new to the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. And so in that book, what I seek to do is to to talk to either somebody who's never been Catholic, like your daughter-in-law, or somebody maybe who fell away and has been gone a long time, to say, here's what it means to be Catholic, and here's what it means to be Catholic. Two different things. You know, you can be Catholic, and what does that entail? But also, what does it mean to be Catholic, to live in a parish, to receive the sacraments? And I go through in the book, why does the Catholic Church do certain things? Why do we stand, sit, kneel at Mass, for example? What happens at Mass? What about devotions? What about Catholic etiquette and customs and things that might not be readily apparent to somebody who's new to the Church? So it's not a very big book. I think it might be 170 pages, 160 pages, but it covers all the basics, and it's intended to be welcoming and encouraging for somebody who, like your daughter-in-law, is new to the Church. So there are a lot of great books out there. This happens to be the one that I wrote on this topic, so I can definitely suggest that one.
Okay. Now, those are the, well, not all of them, but the topics that you cover in your book were not, would not be ones covered in the RCIA program?
Depends on which program the parish used. But no, this is not intended to be like RCIA. This is intended to say, okay, now that you're Catholic, here mm-hmm. are a bunch of things that may seem, you know, hard to understand for you. Let me explain them. So okay. The way I start the book is I say, imagine that you're going to move to a foreign country and you're excited and you're looking forward to all the new sights and sounds and everything, but you're going to have to learn the language and the laws of that country and learn how to get around. And these are all things that eventually you'll learn. It becomes second nature. But in the meantime, here is kind of a crash course in what to expect. That's the way I approach it.
Great. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome. The book, again, it's called Now What? A Guide for New and Not So New Catholics. And I think Cyrus is going to get a link so you can see a picture of it. If you go to, are you on Twitter, Joanne, by chance?
Okay. I live in a cave.
No problem. You will go to relevantradio.com/Patrick.
And I do you'll have see. The internet.
Ah, good. And electricity too, probably, if you have the internet.
Yes.
So go to relevantradio.com/Patrick and you'll see a link to it there so you could see what it looks like.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome. And what a blessed day that your daughter-in-law is coming into the Church. That's got to be very encouraging. Let's go to Maria now in Rhode Island. Hi, Maria.
Hi, Patrick. Thanks. Question sure. about a funeral I was singing at. The priest, the deceased was a woman, and okay. the priest mentioned her wife. And I was a little shocked about that. I wondered if there was an option for him to be bold and tell the family, look, I'm willing to say, like, would the better plan be her, you know, her loved one or dear friend? What is, I mean, obviously the person was Catholic, so I understand having a Catholic funeral, but just as the same as the priest is not able to do a marriage, what is the proper, I was disappointed and kind of wondering what the priest probably would be able to
yeah.
do in that.
Disappointing to say the least, right? Well, yeah. The Church does not recognize as valid a marriage between anyone other than a man and a woman, assuming that a man and a woman can be, assuming that they're eligible to get married. That's the only valid form of marriage there is. So for this priest to refer to her wife, I mean, I'm assuming he probably did so because the law of the state recognizes it, even though the Church doesn't. And who knows whether or not he agrees with the law of the state or not. I don't know, but I could see mm-hmm. why that would be startling to you that he would say that, especially if he said it in a way that suggested that he bought into that ideology. So I want to make sure I understand your question. Are you asking me, is that appropriate that he said that, or what specifically are you asking me?
Definitely. Is that appropriate or not? Because, I mean, all my choir mates said, oh, you're being, you know, bigoted, and he did it for the family and they're legally married. And I said, well, you know, it depends on that, you know, your own mm-hmm. idea of marriage. But so would the priest have been more, what is your opinion about what the priest could have done? You know, certainly you want you're trying to help a grieving family, no doubt. You don't want, be unkind, but what would have been a correct way to, is there a correct way to do that where you could just boldly tell the family,
Yeah, I mean, I can understand the strange position that would put the priest in, because obviously if that woman to whom she was legally married is sitting in the church, how do you address her? How do you refer to her without being unnecessarily hurtful? I could understand why tact would be so important in a case like that. I mean, if you wanted to say something like, and all of her family and friends, there's a way to say it. I mean, to for him to say her wife, maybe he only said it that way because he was trying to acknowledge, it's just a difficult situation, to be sure. And I could see why a priest might say, well, I don't really know how to do it, so I'll just do it this way. But
it's going to come up more and more. I mean, it's easier with the marriage thing because you can tell a couple, I'm sorry. But, this is going to come up more and more, obviously. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, what I'd like to do is – go ahead.
No, please go ahead, Patrick.
Well, I was going to say what I'd like to do is to do a bit of research, because I don't know the answer, but there may be some canon law issue here for there may be some canon law issue here for a rite of Christian burial for somebody who's homosexual and living that lifestyle openly and outwardly. It may be that there are some provisions that would forbid that. I just don't know off the top of my head. So I'd like to do a little bit of study and then maybe come back to you later and be able to say, here's what I found out. Here's what the church says, if there's anything on that topic. But I think there probably is.
Got it. Patrick, really quick on the other caller. Our priest no longer goes to the cemetery after a funeral. I know we have a priest shortage, but what is your take on that?
Well,
have you seen
who
that
goes to
a
the
lot?
Well, honestly, I haven't been to many funerals, thankfully, so I don't know anecdotally, but does somebody from the church, does a deacon or a different priest go there for the graveside burial, or do they just...
I don't think it's... Yeah, I think there. We have a sister. We have a religious. I haven't myself been to any, but that I was real shocked to hear that. I mean, someone needs to be there, right?
Yeah.
And by the way, it's clergy or... Yeah, that's
well,
kind of what I thought.
This is perhaps the pinnacle of grief for the family, is to see the coffin lowered into the ground. And, I mean, I don't know that they stayed to see the dirt being put back over it, but I would think that would be an extremely difficult time. And if ever there were a time when you would want your pastor there to comfort you, it would be then. I can't imagine why... why would Father McKenzie not go to the cemetery? I mean, why not? I mean, why wouldn't you go? If you're there as the pastor, you have care of souls. This is your ministry to help people in times of grief, and to preside over the final phase of a massive Christian burial. To say, well, I'd rather watch a game on TV, or I want to go take a nap. I don't think that's the appropriate thing to do. Now, maybe there's some extenuating circumstance. Maybe he's got some physical issue that prevents him from doing so. And I want to give everyone the benefit of the doubt. So let's assume in good faith that it's something like that, where he's got some kind of legitimate reason not to go. But outside of that, it doesn't seem to me that it's fulfilling his duty as a parish priest.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Patrick. That's very helpful.
You're welcome, Miriam. Thank you. Appreciate that. Let's take a break, and we'll come back to more of the Patrick Madrid Show. I heard a little rumor about some classic rock music possibly being played. We'll see about that. We'll find out
what
the great Cyrus has planned.
It is more than a rumor.
More than a feeling, you might say, huh? All right, coming right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find out more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking. Here we go.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
This is pretty amazing.
This is pretty good. I like it. I can hear that fat bass.
Hear it?
Yeah.
Well, what's amazing to me, well, I'll stop talking. Yeah, so what's amazing to me is that this obscure music that really nobody's ever heard is suddenly now being played coast to coast on over 200 stations, reaching millions of people.
It only took 40 years, but it's finally hit the radio.
Oh, man. Here's the lead singer, Jim Messina.
Run through the lights, you'll see me. I want to stay a simple man.
Now, this seems to have a demo quality to it.
Yeah.
This isn't studio time.
No, I don't think so. Here's what happened. I was going through, so this is a band that I was in from, you know, I've told that story about the Battle of the Bands. This is that band. And so Jim Messina, who just passed away within the last several months, may he rest in peace, he was the guitarist and lead singer, and he wrote these songs. I'm playing bass. And what happened was I was going through a box of stuff at home, and I came across this old cassette tape, and I thought, well, what's on this? And so I didn't have a cassette tape player anymore, so I didn't have anything to play it on. And the tape was actually broken. So I sent it to, and I knew it was some of our music, so I sent it to a guy I knew who did like digitizing and stuff. And he cleaned it up, he mended the tape, and he digitized it so that it could actually hear what it was. And so my recollection is that this was during a rehearsal going back a long time, you know, over 40 years ago, and probably about 43 years ago. And we were in our band room, and we had a boombox with a tape in it, and we were just playing. And it just got lost in the shuffle and went into a box, and I found it all those years later. So this is the music that, if you heard that album, it would have been the studio version of this music. All right.
There's. I'm excited about this. There's so much potential here. Like, this is really good. I wish you could get the band back together.
Wouldn't that be something? Yeah. Well, Jim has passed on to his eternal reward. Oh, I think I have a. Do I have a bass solo here?
No, that was the end of the song.
That was it. So that song starts with a bit of a bass solo. But yeah, so it was fun, and I remember the day when I was. Having a heart-to-heart with Nancy, and I just so much wanted to make rock and roll music my career. And Nancy said, you're not going to be able to feed a family doing that. And truer words were never spoken. And so I said, you know what, honey? You're right. So I packed up my bass guitar, and that was it. Didn't do that anymore.
You know, I think I speak for a lot of people listening. You did the right thing. But this music is awesome. I like
it. Thank you.
And you asked about that bass solo.
There it is.
Yeah,
there it is. Oh, that's fun. Well, thanks for that, Cyrus. It's kind of cool. And I think you posted a link to that on Twitter, right? So people who want to.
I did, yeah. So head over to relevantradio.com/Patrick, and it should be right there on the top.
Super cool. Thank you. That's a walk down memory lane. Let's go to where are we going? Lisa in Arlington, Virginia. Good morning, Lisa. Hello, Lisa. Welcome.
Hi. I have a question for you. I've been waiting for so long. But I don't know how to formulate it, so forgive me. I'm
That's
going
okay.
to do the best I can.
All is forgiven, Lisa. All is forgiven.
What's the hierarchy of prayer? I understand. I read it a long time ago, but when I say that, I mean, like, what is the military terms for us when we pray? We are considered the militia. What's the level for saints, and what's the level for our family members who are in heaven? And
okay.
What's the level for Mary, or I think you understand what I mean. When
I
we pray
so.
To them, what is their form or their title, you know, military title for prayer?
Okay. I don't know if I've ever been asked that question before, so I'll do my best. When we're thinking about like hierarchy within the body of Christ, if that's what you mean, we're all members of the body of Christ. Those of us in this life who are still fighting the good fight, as St. Paul says, we're known as the church militant. And then the church suffering would be those souls who have passed on and who are going to heaven, but they have to be purified for a time in purgatory. We call them the church suffering. And then we call the saints in heaven who have made it, and they're there with God and praying for us. We call them the church triumphant. So we're all members, equal members of the body of Christ. But if that's what you mean by a hierarchy, that's one way to understand it. Okay. We know from James chapter 5, it says that the prayer of a righteous person is very powerful. And so we can extrapolate from that to say that if our prayers in this life have some power to them because of whatever extent somebody is righteous, which is to be like God in holiness, well, we can say that those in heaven are perfected in righteousness, and therefore their prayers are even more powerful. So if you're thinking about a hierarchy in terms of the power of prayer, the efficacy of prayer, the Bible seems pretty clear that the saints in heaven are much more powerful in their prayers than we are. And they're described in the book of Hebrews as having been made perfect in righteousness. So, you know, the spirits of just men made perfect. The word just there is a synonym for righteousness or righteous men. So they've been made perfect. So they in heaven have a higher degree of power and efficacy in their prayer, if that's part of what you mean by that. And then I think you asked, did you ask something about the kinds of prayer, or am I just interpolating that into your question? Like different degrees of prayer?
Yeah, okay. Exactly. The degrees of prayer.
Okay, well, another way to look at this, and this was something that St. Teresa of Avila wrote quite a bit about. St. Francis de Sales also wrote about this, but I think probably one of the most systematized treatises on this issue that I'm about to explain was given by St. Teresa of Avila. And in her book called The Interior Mansion, she outlines the steps of progress from being, you know, a flat-out sinner, not really caring about God and the things of God. And then as you progress more and more deeply, you move through, and I believe there are a total of 7 different phases or stages that she describes, but within those stages are the kinds of prayer that you typically see in a person in different stages of the spiritual life. So rote prayers, the kind of prayers that we would say out loud, the Hail Mary, the Our Father, the prayers that we've memorized, those are good, and those are kind of the foundation of prayers at the lowest level, you might say, like all those discursive prayers. And that would also include prayers that are not memorized, but prayers that come up extemporaneously from your heart. So when you're just praying, you're not reading a prayer, you're not saying a prayer that you've memorized, you're just praying, you're talking to God in your own words. That and the rote prayers would be in the basic level. Then you would progress, St. Teresa says, more and more into the next level, which you leave behind. You don't leave behind in the sense that you no longer make use of those prayers. We do. But you then move into an area that is known as meditation. And in meditation, you are now actively applying your mind and your heart to God and the things of God. You're pondering and thinking about and studying in your mind, you might say, through prayer, these eternal truths, God himself. And then the deepest level of prayer, she says, is known as contemplation. And that's where you're no longer actively exercising your intellect on a topic. You're not pondering in that way. You're not actively studying it in prayer, but rather you're gazing upon God in the things of God. And one person who really stands out in my mind as describing that third and deepest level of prayer is the curé of Ars, St. John Vianney. And he was asked, what do you do when you pray? Because he was known as such a holy man. And his answer was, I look at God and he looks at me. And that's a really succinct way of explaining this deeper or the deepest level of prayer, where you're just contemplating God. You're resting in a peaceful contemplation, gazing upon God, and he's gazing upon you. Now, it's easy to try to talk about it. It's not so easy to try to do it. But that's where St. Teresa of Avila comes in. She can guide you in how to get to that level.
Okay. Thank you so much, and have a blessed day.
Thank you. I appreciate that. The book, by the way, again, is called The Interior Castle. And it's a classic in the field. The translation that I'm most familiar with is by E. Allison Pierce, and that's readily available online. Let's go to Joe now in Doylestown, PA. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Patrick. Hey, I got a loaded question here.
Okay.
So in regards to the demon legion that asked Jesus to go into the swines, you've often said, like, there's no mention of charity in hell, and they're not in hell. But in this exchange, the demon is pleading, and Jesus acquiesces to the request in charity. So I was just kind of, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't know that I would have the last part on in charity, because I don't know that it was, strictly speaking, charity for the devil. I mean, God, in a certain sense, you could say God has charity for the devil in that he keeps him in existence. And that must be very galling to the devil, because he's not entirely bad. Part of him is good, and that's this communicable attribute of God, existence. God is existence, and he communicates that attribute to those beings that he brings into existence. So in a certain sense, there is some vestige of goodness even in the devil, and that is that he exists. So if we want to think about charity on God's part, or love for his creatures insofar as he keeps them in existence, we could say that. But I don't know that Jesus permitted the demons to go into the swine as an act of charity per se. Rather, I could see that as a demonstration of the futility of the demonic activity. They want to be in a thing. They want to try to get into a physical object, ideally a human being. But short of that, then an animal, and short of that, I guess, an inanimate object. So, but even the futility is demonstrated, because once they go into the swine are spooked and they drown in the water, and then the demons have to come back out of them again. So I don't see that necessarily as an act of charity, strictly speaking. That may be where I have a different view of this than you do, Joe. What are your thoughts?
No, that explains it. But the question you just said kind of teased me off here a bit. It says, when the demon goes into the swines, they go headlong into the sea and drown. So what happens to the demons? I mean, do they go and try to embody someone else?
Yeah, I think so. So as we look at the story of Christ's public ministry, we see at every step practically him casting out demons, and how he sends the 70 out to cast out demons. So it was a big part of the Lord's public ministry. So it seems that, and we can know this by other things in Scripture about, like St. Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 5, that the devil is like a roaring lion prowling around looking for someone to devour. I see in that a reminder that not only the devil per se, but also all the demons beneath him, that they are always looking for an opportunity to burrow their way in wherever they can. And so with all of these demon-possessed people, it seems pretty clear to me that once they were cast out, they would be looking for some other place, some other opportunity. And Jesus actually even gives us an example of this, where he talks about a man who is freed of a demon, and he sweeps his house and cleans everything up. The demon comes back and sees that everything's cleaned up, so he leaves and he gets seven more demons, and they come back and they enter into this man again, and his second state is worse than his first, because now there are more demons who have gone into him. So clearly they want to find their way in, even if it's just an animal, and that didn't work out so well for them.
Okay. Yeah, that's great. That sets me straight. I appreciate it.
Happy to. And of course, I would look to the true masters on this topic would be those exorcists who have written their stories and told their accounts of their interaction with the demons. I would look to them for something more authoritative. The book I mention often is the one that I read. It's called An Exorcist Tells His Story by Father Gabriel Amorth, published by our friends at Ignatius Press. So if you want a book that will kind of lead you more into the details of things like that, that would be a good one to use. Thank you. Oh, yeah, break time. I was just about to go to another call. That wouldn't have been a good idea. All right, so we'll be right back. It is Taco Tuesday, and we'll celebrate a little bit more on the other side of this quick timeout.
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
Now that's what I call a taco.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149.
Taco Town!
That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Taco Town!
Yes, yes, Taco Town. Let's go to Sandra in Oregon. Hi, Sandra. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Patrick. I just wonder if you can give me an advice of a situation that I have here in my house with my niece. Okay. I have three nieces that live with me. Three of them, they're 20 to 22.
Okay.
And by the way, if they don't live with me, they wouldn't have a place to be right now. So okay. It's very difficult for me that one of them is so into tarot cards, crystals, incense, and all that kind of stuff. Mm. And I talked to my priest about it, but he said, just pray for her, just knowing her situation. That's why I just feel very uncomfortable having that stuff in my house.
Yeah.
And I have talked to her about it, and she most take it like joking, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I try to approach her in different ways, and she has that added to the long as she doesn't in her room, she does not bother anybody. So at this point, honestly, really, it's very uncomfortable feeling knowing that in part of my house is all these items, mm-hmm. and I want them out of my house.
You have the right to tell her that. You have the right. Say, I love having you here. I love you. I want to take care of you. But this is a rule that we don't have anything of the occult in this home. So I understand if you don't want to part with that, but you'll have to find a different place to live. But we don't have those here. Now, I could imagine that if she's that attached to it, that she might pretend to throw them away and still have them there. And that's where your trust level will come in. How much do you trust her? But I would draw the line and very firmly but lovingly say, that's just something that's non-negotiable. We won't have that in this house. And then,
yeah, thank you.
Yeah, and then she has to make a decision. Now, if she's willing to listen to you, then evangelize her. You know, explain to her why, if she really wants to be a follower of Jesus, she has to turn her back on this darkness, turn her back on these portals into the underworld, because it's trying to tap into contact with demonic entities, even though she doesn't understand that. That's exactly what's happening. So. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can give her a very, very, you know, pointed, robust evangelization. Talk to her about Jesus. Help her get on Team Jesus. Maybe she will, maybe she won't. I don't know. But it's dangerous for you. It's certainly dangerous for her, but it's also dangerous for you to have these things under the roof in your home. And you have every right to insist that they be gone.
Yeah, and I called you because I hear you talk about this with different people that called before, mm-hmm. and it just didn't settle right with me that just pray for her and knowing that, you know, she has all these items in the house. And also, if I can, please, do you have ever heard of magnets to use for healing people?
I have, yeah.
I mean, I don't know much about it, but my sensei told me that it's the same kind of area with all these stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I have a family member that they walk so much on this area.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to know if this is...
Well, let's draw a distinction here. So this mm-hmm. is what I would classify as a kind of alternative medicine that people will say, well, these magnets, they will restore health to joints or they stimulate muscle health or whatever it is. I've even known some people who have gone down that road. That is not in the realm of the occult. That to me, at least as it's commonly practiced, is sort of a credulous belief in this alternative therapy that, from what I understand, doesn't really do anything. That's different than tarot cards and Ouija boards and seances and palm reading and things like that. Those are clearly dangerous because they are of the occult and they're associated with the devil. Magnets, not so much in my view. So that's something I would be less concerned about. Strikes me as kind of goofy, honestly, but not dangerous. But these things are more dangerous. So I would encourage you to stand your ground, be loving, but be firm and just say, we're not doing that in this house. And if you're not willing to part from those things, then you're going to have to move because we won't do that here. Thanks, Sandra. Hang in there. Let's go now to David in Oakland. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Patrick. I'm calling in response to the woman who was concerned that the priest was not going out to the cemetery to say the committal prayers.
Yeah.
And the reason I'm calling is I do work at a Catholic cemetery, and I've read through the lectionary for the Rite of Christian Burials, and they do allow for priests to say the committal prayers at the church.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes there's circumstances where, because of weather, they can't go out.
No, I understand that. And that's why I said at the tail end of my commentary, David, I agree with you. I said, let's assume the best and let's give people a benefit of the doubt. And let's assume that there was some real reason that the priest was not able to go and do that. So I definitely include that in trying to consider this situation. But all other things being equal, if the parish priest just didn't feel like it, that to me seems like, well, this is what you're here to do. You're here to minister to these people in their time of need. And I realize it's less convenient to do that, but I would like to think that if I were a priest, I'm not, but if I were a priest, that's the kind of thing that I would go the extra mile for the sake of helping the grieving family. That's what I meant by that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I agree with you on that. The other piece that I thought was good to know would be that there are rubrics inside the Rite of Christian Burial for the committal service that are specific to lay people. So it'll say, if you're a priest, you say this prayer. If you're not a priest, you say this prayer. So I've had situations working at the cemetery where, for whatever reason, there was no priest. And so I made sure I followed the rules, and read the prayers the right way, so I wasn't overstepping my bounds. But at the same time, providing prayers which the family really appreciates, they need prayer at that time.
I agree, and so this actually gets back to the point I was making. I'm glad you brought this up. If I were the grieving survivor, I think it would be very nice if you were to do this for our family, David. But I would rather have the priest do it, because you would be acting in an extraordinary manner, and kudos to you. But to have a layperson fulfill these functions is not the ideal situation, and sometimes it's necessary and good, so I'm not knocking it. But if the priest is available and he can do this, my view is he should do this. Why delegate it to a layperson when it's something that is directly in his ministry? And if he's got the care of souls, as pastors do, all the more so. It just seems like, well, why wouldn't you want to go the extra mile to help console this grieving family? And I could easily imagine how maybe some people in the family think, well, Father couldn't be bothered to come to the cemetery. And, if he's sick, or if there's another appointment he has to keep, or if there's some extenuating circumstance, I totally get it. And those things happen. But short of that, what kind of message does that send? It's just like, I'd rather, what I'm saying. And I'm not trying to grind on anybody, but that's my honest reaction to it.
Yeah, and I'll say that in situations where I've done the committal prayers, it's been as a backup because things didn't work the way they desired them to. They wanted to have a clergy person do it, and because of whatever extenuating circumstances happened, they couldn't be there, and so it's better to have prayers than not have prayers, and if I'm allowed to say them, then
sure.
I will.
Sure. Well, you and I are on the same page on that. And just to reiterate, I don't knock that at all. And I recognize that there are times when that's necessary and very helpful. Right. So nothing but kudos on that. All I'm saying is that in a situation where the priest doesn't have some reason, some real reason, why he couldn't go the extra mile and be at the cemetery with the family at that final phase, and he just doesn't do it, that to me is not pastoral, honestly.
Yeah, I agree with that. So, yeah. But okay, well, hey, thanks for taking my call. And
you got it, David. Appreciate that. 888-914-9149. How about Nikki now in Wausau, Wisconsin? Good morning, Nikki.
Good morning. Happy Taco Tuesday.
yes.
I have a question about marriage prep.
Okay.
If 50% or more of Catholics are divorcing, what did your tweet say, 8 years or less?
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't marriage prep be more rigorous to, like, almost have the goal of breaking couples up? And, like, what would, like, I've also heard criticism of, like, the annulment process and how they're, especially in the U.S., passed out like candy was the very
yeah.
cynical view of it. But, like, that's kind of my question. Like, how does this all relate, marriage prep versus annulment, divorce, like, it all
yeah.
seems related?
I can understand your point, Nikki. Now, what your question made me think of is going back now 42 plus years. My wife and I are celebrating our 42nd wedding anniversary next week. So this is already on my mind. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. So I'm remembering when we went on what was called then an engaged encounter. That was required for the diocese marriage prep requirements. And so you'd go on a weekend at a place where they would have a priest and there'd be some team couples, married couples. And then you would go through kind of like a marriage encounter, although we've never been on a marriage encounter weekend. I'm told it's kind of like that, but you're not sleeping together in the same room. You're obviously living separately for the weekend because you're not married. But I remember, and I forget now whether it was the priest or it might have been one of the couples, team couple, who told us at the end of the weekend or near the end, there were a couple of couples who had been there to start with us, and there might have been 20 engaged couples to start, and a couple of them broke up over that weekend. And the priest said, that is part of the goal. Not to intentionally break up couples, that's not the goal, but rather that if this couple doesn't really have the necessary ingredients to have a happy marriage, better that they break up now than they break up after they're married. So he said there's a certain attrition rate, or there was at least during those weekends, and part of the process was intended to bring these things to the surface so that the husband or the fiancés could see, we're really not supposed to get married. So to your point, I think that's a wise pattern to follow if the teaching and the pedagogy is to help bring to the surface these issues that the man and the woman may never have talked about before. They may not realize, oh, she wants a lot of kids. I don't want any kids. Or, oh, you know, this means we're going to have to share our finances together. You know, no separate checkbooks. We're going to have to, you know, share and share alike. And maybe one or the other isn't ready to do that. Whatever the reason may be, I see wisdom in trying to get those to the surface so that if they're going to break up, do it then, before they get married. That's what it sounds like you're referring to, right? Marriage prep that would have the way...
Sorry, I will listen offline. Ivana, my baby just started crying.
No problem. I know you got a lot on your hands, Nikki. I can hear the little baby. Okay, well, fair enough. I think I've said about everything I can say on that topic, but those are my thoughts. Thank you for that. Let's go to Sarah now in San Diego. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Patrick. My question is about Reiki. I was getting my hair cut, and the woman, the stylist, was washing my hair in the bowl and doing a scalp massage. And whenever anybody touches me, I pray the St. Michael prayer just because I'm aware of the New Age, the Reiki, all of this stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I was praying the prayer to St. Michael the entire time just because I felt something a little bit weird.
Okay.
And I had my crucifix on, of course. Later on, as she's cutting my hair, she tells me that she does Reiki in the massage bowl. And she loves the salon because the owner allows her to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I got chills down my spine, and I was just really, you know, I let her finish cutting my hair, and I asked her if she did it right before I left. Mm-hmm. She said she did not, and she would never do that without my permission. She would have to discuss it with me first. And if mm-hmm. it's something I would like to do, she'd want to talk to me about it. I said, well, I am Catholic, and it is wrong for me to do that. I would never want to do that. I said, and I think you should be aware of that, you know, you think you're doing something good, but it can open up different realms. Bad spirits can enter and so on. And she said, oh, no. She just cut me off. She said, no. I do a big cleanse before. That doesn't happen. And I just walked
out. We're just about out of time.
I felt, okay.
I'm not trying to shut you down. Go ahead.
My question is, do I need a blessing after that, or could she have done anything else?
No. I don't think so, no. Remember, the Bible says, greater is he who is in you than he who is in the world. And so if you're in the state of grace and you are close to Jesus and receiving the sacraments, you have nothing to fear. But, you know, obviously, I wouldn't go back to her. if you had a choice of where to go, I wouldn't go back to her. When I come back tomorrow, I'll share a book. Thank you, Sarah. Appreciate it. Just wish you had more time. I'll share a book. From a Catholic perspective that critiques Reiki. We'll do that tomorrow, same Pat time, same Pat channel. Until then, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.
Happy Taco Tuesday.